Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode contains material that may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
It's actually a very tragic story with the father being mentally ill and eating all the food of the large family, and in this way being very mean.
In the early 90s, Finland grappled with a devastating economic downturn, plunging an already impoverished family into deeper despair. In this dire situation, the brothers of the family had to find a way out of their hardships.
My understanding is that at the beginning, they simply just needed to get money to eat something, to have food. And this is how it started.
And this is how a significant crime wave started. During 18 months, the brothers committed over 100 daring thefts and heists, leaving the police baffled.
Nobody was suspecting them for a long time. And maybe, you know, they just got more hungry, so to say, with successful events of their crimes.
But as more valuable items began appearing in the yard of their modest home, they started attracting the wrong kind of attention. The brothers, now deeply entangled in their life of crime, were losing control over their rapidly escalating spree.
It was addictive, like a game or alcohol addiction. When you're getting that kind of money, it's hard to stop.
You're listening to Nordic Crimes, the Dalton Brothers of Eura. In Finland, the beginning of the 90s leaves the country a wound we will need decades to recover from. An economic depression hit the country in 1991, crashing the economy so fast and so deep, worse than ever after the wars, leaving every fifth of Finnish working-age people unemployed, whilst the social security is being cut and taxes are being raised. Not just economically, the depression rate raises amongst the Finns. And so does suicide rates. According to studies, 14,500 people committed suicide because of the 90s economic depression. The worst suffering hit families with children, and the studies show how the children of depression still carry those wounds. With 500,000 people unemployed, the banks are crashing, and the ones that are surviving, they are being robbed by desperate people. During 3 years of depression, every week a bank in Finland would face an armed robbery. On average, one bank in every 3 days. At the end of the 90s, a strange series of thefts started happening in Western Finland. It's not armed robberies like during the Depression, but someone is collecting cash machines during nighttime in small towns' gas stations. The police are left scratching their heads.
Ilta-Sanomat, Tuesday, 3rd November, 1998. A jet gas station cash machine was stolen by thieves in Rauma. They tore a cash machine from its pedestal the night before last night. 1.5-meter-tall machine was stolen during midnight around 12 o'clock to 2 a.m. The police suspect the machine was pulled from its pedestal with the help of a car. The missing cash machine of the jet gas station was noticed by a police patrol who drove past the scene. The only thing left from the machine was its pedestal and the receipt automat. The cash machine and the money in it are still missing.
In total, the stolen amount was 5,000 marks, equivalent to roughly 1,300 euros today. Not a substantial haul, yet this was just the tip of the iceberg. Later, a gas station in a different small town was robbed under the cover of night, with the culprits amassing tens of thousands of marks. Over the next several months, a series of similar crimes plagued the region. Cash machines were uprooted, cars and wheel loaders vanished throughout Western Finland, and the police remained in the dark about the perpetrators. Come April 99, the thieves upgraded their tactics. Rather than dislodging entire machines, they drilled into them, swiftly extracting the cash. This method allowed them to haul in more money in less time. But while cash machines were being targeted, an even grander scheme was underway. On August 30th, 99, in a town named Musku, a post office was raided. Using a steel wire rope inserted through a shattered window, the thieves yanked out the entire safe. The loot? A whopping 279,000 marks, nearly 70,000 euros in today's value. The following month, a bold theft of 75 kilos of dynamite occurred, and more explosives disappeared across Western Finland. On December 20th, 99, Merita Bank in Eura experienced a break-in. Although aware of the incident, overstretched police postponed the investigation. A local detective began suspecting the notorious Koistinen brothers, known troublemakers in Eura. Then, on Christmas Eve, another bank, Osuuspankki, right beside Merita, was robbed. The criminals made off with goods worth over 175,000 euros in today's currency. This high-profile heist pushed the police to prioritize their investigation, with suspicions circling back to the Koistinen brothers. Despite lacking concrete evidence, a search warrant for the Koistinen residence was soon issued.
I woke up to the police saying, "Erki, are you ever going to wake up?" That wasn't a great wake-up. My mouth was so dry I couldn't even swallow. That's when I realized we were in a tough spot. My name's Erki Koistinen, and it's been quite a journey to get to where I am today. I'm hoping there's still a path forward for me, just with fewer bumps along the way.
The Koistinen brothers were indeed the culprits. In December 99, on Christmas Eve, the four siblings split a sizable sum of 700,000 marks. However, the very next business day greeted them with an unexpected wake-up call. The police standing beside their beds.
For around a year and a half, we were deeply into stealing. Almost like a hobby. The last time we did it was Christmas 99 at a bank. That's when we got caught. The police raided our house and found all the money from the bank. My portion was hidden under my pillow. Not the cleverest place, I admit. There was also about 20,000 marks and coins under the bed, plus the banknotes under my pillow.
In Erki Koistinen's room alone, a staggering 175,000 marks were discovered, most of which were stashed beneath his bed. The reasons pushing the four brothers, hailing from a devout family of 11 siblings, to embark on this criminal path were more intricate than anyone might have guessed. Erki's parents crossed paths in 1968, united by their involvement in the Lestadian religious revivalist movement. They were aligned with its conservative faction, the Levite branch, which prides itself with upholding the original Lestadian teachings. This conservative branch is best recognized for its aversion to alcohol, television, and its firm stance on controlling family size. The Koistinen parents vigorously adhered to the latter. Their family blossomed rapidly, welcoming children in 1970, 71, 72, 74, 75, 76, 77, with Erki arriving in 78, followed by his younger siblings in 80, 81, 82, and 84. But familial issues emerged in the 70s when the father obstructed the children's education. Social workers intervened, offering financial incentives to encourage him to let the children attend school. This approach met with sporadic success, as the father's stance kept fluctuating. Institutionalized briefly, he returned home in the early 80s, harboring heightened animosity towards society. As his mental health deteriorated, so did the family's plight.
I think it was when I was about 2 years old, not long after I was born, that our dad first went to the mental hospital. That left us kids under our mom's care, and she was overwhelmed, taking care of so many of us by herself. We were pretty much left on our own, doing whatever we pleased.
In a book, written right after the four brothers got caught, the siblings remember mostly how hungry they were throughout their childhood. The father would disappear for days, come back and eat all the food whilst the starving children would watch him eat. The father would say, "An elephant has an appetite of an elephant. A mouse has an appetite of a mouse." The poverty and hunger drove the children to find food elsewhere. They would go to nearby stables and steal dry bread that was meant for horses. The children would also go from door to door, begging their neighbors to give them something to eat. At times, they did receive some food, but often, they were turned away.
My name is Taija Stout. I'm a psychologist, and I worked for a long time with criminals, and I've also studied and made research on recidivism, so in relation to reoffending. If we consider the Dalton brothers, I personally think that it's actually a very interesting ethical or moral question for all of us to ponder, that if you are living in a family where you are super poor and you don't have even food, and it's actually a very tragic story with the father being mentally ill and eating all the food of the large family, and in this way being very mean. So the children were forced also to simply to try to find food to survive. So it's an interesting question for all of us to ponder that, you know, when listening and understanding their story and their family background, you feel empathy towards them. And these sort of human warm feelings are also created inside many of us towards them. And my understanding is that, well, when their case was more in the public and it was ongoing, people were somehow divided in this, that some felt the empathy and sympathy towards them because of their circumstances. And some were, of course, strongly saying that it doesn't justify for their crimes, which is true. But yeah, so it's an interesting somehow question and pondering for all of us.
Money was always tight. Dad would use the social benefits meant for us, the kids, for himself, instead of buying food for the family. That led us to scour landfills, looking for bottles to return for cash, just to get money for food. But looking back, those memories have a kind of sweetness to them over time. In a strange way, it was a wonderful time, from what I can recall. It felt like freedom. We were free and beyond anyone's control. We did whatever we wanted. We hardly went to school. I remember teachers chasing us through the woods trying to catch us. Our childhood was really wild.
Nearly all Koistinen siblings frequented the landfill, including the youngest, who'd crawl and play amidst the waste. While older siblings scavenged for useful items, the youngest immersed herself in imaginative games. One sister recalls a particular find, a coffee cup set from the landfill, still in use at their family home. Any modest earnings the Koistinen children derived from landfill finds were often seized by their father. He'd either persuade them into handing it over or outright steal from them. One time, one of the Koistinen brothers had broken his thigh bone, and the father visited him in the hospital, only to steal his son's wallet. The children weren't sure where all the money went, but they knew their father disappeared in hotels with other women.
Our dad could be physically violent towards us sometimes. He'd hit our fingers and backsides with sticks. But it was the emotional violence that was really tough. That part was so bad, it's hard to put into words. He was sensitive, would break into tears suddenly, and then in the next moment, he'd become cruel and mean. I have memories from my childhood starting when I was 8. My dad would steal money from us, his own kids. That's a hard thing to swallow, even now. It's tough to understand and forgive. I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. I'll never forget making pot coasters out of plywood and selling them door to door. When I got home, my dad would take most of the money I'd made. That experience, I think, made me and my brothers bitter. In a way, it played a part in the things we ended up doing. There were frustrating things about our dad, but he had his good sides too. He introduced us to technical stuff, like fixing cars. He'd let us weld and use his tools. He never stopped us from trying things. He let us learn by doing. That's probably why I'm the way I am now. I'm not scared to fix things, to try new things. I learned all that as a kid without any formal education. From a young age, we were messing with explosives. I wasn't even 10 when we started using dynamite, like for fishing. We learned all that really young.
I mean, of course, it affects a child, but the effects doesn't inevitably mean that the children will start to commit crimes. Also, when we consider the family, it's a large family with many children, and not all of them are committing crimes. So, of course, when we are looking at factors which often have a correlation with, you know, that who somehow goes to the criminal path, so to say, there are many elements present there in their family background and the surroundings. But we also know that not all the siblings, you know, became criminals. So it's not a linear sort of relationship between those elements. There are certain factors which, like in the professional sort of context, are called criminogenic factors. So meaning those elements which have the strongest somehow correlation that a person is ending up committing crimes. And we have their like poor family background and exactly like, you know, not being integrated with society. And also that they start in a very young age. There is no clear-cut answer what causes crime, because if we would know an answer to that, we probably would have hopefully done something with it so that we could prevent crimes. But we globally have not been able to do this.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
In 1991, the children's uncle persuaded his sister to divorce her husband. The mother, along with her 11 children, moved to Eura to stay with her uncle, who lived just a short distance from their previous home in Moscow. While the uncle tried to protect the family from the father, his strict religious upbringing proved challenging for the children. Accustomed to a life with little oversight, this drastic change was overwhelming for them. Even though they no longer faced hunger, their overall quality of life seemed unchanged. For instance, under the uncle's rules, a dog belonging to one of the Koistinen daughters was tragically killed, as no animals were permitted in his house. The local police in Eura was notified about the Koistinen family's arrival. This was not due to concerns about the children, but because of their father's notorious behavior. In Moscow, he had unplugged the refrigerator, convinced the government used it to spy on him. He frequently penned paranoid letters, even addressing some to the president of Finland. The detective working on the boy's case recalls in the book how he often had to pick up the children from their uncle's home to ensure they attended school. At times, the boys would attempt to escape, leading to impromptu foot races as they tried to flee through the house's back window.
This place here, this is our mom's cottage. And this is the bad boy's house. This place is even on the cover of the book. Our mom still lives here, and I think my nephew's inside right now. Not sure if we should disturb them.
In 1996, the children and their mother moved into a house in Mestile, where their mother continues to live. Before this move, their uncle had evicted them, unable to handle the unruly behavior of the boys. Mestile, a part of Eura, provided the family with a two-story country house through social services. It marked the first time the family lived without a male figure present. Local residents were apprehensive about the notorious brothers moving into the neighborhood. This led to several complaints, drawing the attention of a detective who would frequently visit their home. During one visit, after reports of the boys shooting in a forest, the detective discovered a 200-liter gas canister they had recently stolen. In 1998, tensions escalated between the brothers and their neighbors, primarily over the noise from the brothers' cross bikes. In retaliation, the brothers obstructed roads with large rocks and stuffed neighbors' chimneys with paper. They even made homemade bombs, which alarmed not only the community, but also their mother. By spring of 1998, the detective urged the boys to cease their disruptive behaviors, and they agreed. For a time, calm seemed to return to the town. However, as the decade drew to a close, the family's finances began to deteriorate. Despite the brothers' employment, they struggled to pay bills and provide food. The closest siblings in the family knew they had to take action.
I guess there was some bitterness towards society. That's probably what it was. It's hard for me to analyze it now. I could have followed a more traditional career path, but I didn't choose that direction.
The path Erki and his three brothers chose was far from a typical career path.
Anyway, let's go see the sites of our old crimes. We'll head towards the main...
In 1997, two of the Koistinen brothers carried out their first theft by taking machines from two phone booths in Oura. Although they didn't get much money, the excitement spurred them on. The next year, in October 1998, one of the brothers tried to unbolt a cash machine at a gas station. He didn't manage to do it, and while his brothers initially joked about his failure, they all became more interested as they kept discussing it. That October, they worked together on their first significant theft. They broke into a local diner and stole the slot machine.
We wanted to see if there was money in a piazzo, a coin slot machine. We broke in with a crowbar, hauled the piazzo outside, and took the coins. It was 3,800 marks. That's when our ambition really started to grow.
And their ambition grew much bigger. Inspired by a magazine story about a stolen cash machine, they decided to emulate the feat. In November 1998, they targeted the same Jet gas station mentioned in the article. Edgar didn't join in this first time, but after seeing his brother's success, he was part of every theft they did afterward.
That's how it all really started. From there, we began doing jobs weekly, sometimes even several times a week.
And they were constantly up to something. One theft in November 98, 10 in December 98, 4 in January 99, 2 in February, and 1 in March 99. But in April 99, they were especially active, pulling off 17 thefts.
Oh, right here, there used to be an old gas station. It's not in use now, but back in 99, we broke into it. We made off with about 27,000 marks. It was a big score. I mean, it's not right to be proud of crimes, but...
For this particular gas station in Sekula, that's no longer in use, the brothers had started using the drill.
Eventually, the cash machines were bolted down so well we couldn't yank them out. We even broke a towing hook trying, so we had to think of something else. We examined one machine we'd hidden in a forest and figured out that drilling a hole in a certain spot would open it easily.
After mastering the drill technique, their operations ran smoothly. In just a span from April to May 1999, they successfully completed 33 break-ins using the drill.
My understanding is that at the beginning, they simply just needed to get money to eat something, to have food. And this is how it started. And then maybe also this escalated during the years. There was probably, I mean, I'm sure they also wanted to have those things which their peers had, you know, whatever, you know, teenagers would want to have similar clothes even and things like this. Looking at them from outside, they were well-behaving youngsters. Nobody was suspecting them for a long time. And maybe, you know, they just got more hungry, so to say, with successful events of their crimes. And as we know, more and more expensive things started to appear on their yard also, which then led others to suspect that where is this poor family getting all the money from?
Locals began to notice the brothers' sudden ability to purchase new items. When investigating the motocross bikes that neighbors had complained about, the detective questioned how the boys could afford them. The brothers insisted they had bought the bikes with their own money after finding them advertised in the Yellow Pages.
People in town must have wondered about all the cars and boats appearing in our yard. They probably gossiped about how the Koistinen brothers bought another car.
The brothers splurged on motocross bikes, fashionable clothes, and new cars. After a particularly lucrative job, one brother even acquired a Chevrolet Jeep, while Erki chose a Toyota Corolla. Their sudden wealth raised eyebrows, not only among the police, but within their own family. While the brothers covered the family's bills and groceries, The array of expensive items they flaunted didn't add up on a regular salary. This discrepancy left their siblings concerned. In the book about this case, one sister recounts her inquiries about the money. The brothers brushed off her questions, claiming lottery wins. Initially, the sisters wanted to believe no wrongdoing was involved. However, as news of theft spread, they started connecting the dots, secretly hoping their brothers would stop before crossing a point of no return. But as with any addiction, quitting is easier said than done.
We got carried away with the success of our jobs. The rewards were too good. It was addictive, like a game or alcohol addiction. When you're getting that kind of money, it's hard to stop. But the police put an end to it. I guess we have to thank them for breaking our addiction.
But for a considerable time, the police didn't catch on to the brothers' actions, never suspecting them capable of such crimes.
They suspected us of all sorts of crimes, but not the ones we were actually doing. Things like cottage robberies, which we hadn't done. They were on the wrong track for a long time. We had lots of irons in the fire, riding motocross bikes, getting up to all sorts. People saw us as mischievous, but they had no idea about the bigger things we were up to.
As is typical with addiction, the brothers craved greater risks for higher rewards. Even though drilling cash machines made theft simpler, the hauls from these jobs were inconsistent, ranging from a meager 150 marks, barely 38 euros today, to 27,000 marks from the gas station job in Säkylä, worth about 6,800 euros now. Their appetites had escalated to the point where these sums no longer satisfied them.
Then we started thinking we needed more money. We started eyeing the National Post bureaus in their safes. In Moscow, they had a safe, not a vault. We wondered if we could get it out. So we tried. We broke a window, used a front loader to pull the safe out, loaded it on a truck, and opened it elsewhere. That first big job netted us 280,000 marks. And that got us thinking about more such jobs.
The brothers were understandably thrilled with their latest haul. It was more than they had ever made from all their previous jobs put together. Prior to this, their total earnings amounted to nearly 61,000 euros in today's money. Now, from just this one job, they had nearly 70,000 euros. Before their eventual capture, the Koistinen brothers had a close call. In the months following their successful post office heist, they continued to target cash machines. Yet they yearned for another big score similar to their recent triumph. They set their sights on a post office in Turku, a larger town with the promise of a heftier payout. Their plan for the Turku operation mirrored their successful one in Moscow. They appropriated a truck and a front loader, fastened the cable to the safe, and the cable snapped. The safe, wedged behind a pillar, wouldn't budge. A stronger cable might have torn down the building itself, but their cable just created a noisy spectacle with a loud snap and sparks flying. The brothers fled in their truck, but with police in pursuit, they quickly abandoned the slow-moving vehicle for the cover of the woods. One brother lagged behind, expecting the pursuing police dog to tackle him at any moment. But fortune favored them. The dog, still in training, hesitated and eventually retreated. This close shave didn't deter the brothers. They continued planning ambitious jobs while still drilling into cash machines.
That mall over there still has the cash machine. That's where the old Merita and Ostrobanki banks were. We broke into them in 99. This building here was Merita Bank. We went in through the roof, aiming for the vault, but ended up in the storeroom by mistake, just half a meter from the vault. But a week later, we hit the bank next door and got into the vault.
The brothers targeted Ostrobanki twice. On their first attempt, they broke in through a rooftop hatch and managed to breach the inner ceiling. However, they found the vault's roof impenetrable with just their tools. Returning on Christmas Eve of 1999, equipped with a drill and explosives, they found the quiet of the snow-covered environment ideal for their noisy work, allowing them to operate undisturbed.
We used to climb up those ladders to the bank's roof. I was on watch up there once, saw police cars driving by, and wondered if they were coming for us. There was a fight at a bar nearby, and they went there instead. I had to decide whether to warn the others, but I kept my cool.
Their escapades brought the Koistinen brothers not just excitement, but a sense of unity as well.
It was something. Doing those jobs with my brothers, we did everything together since we were kids. Those were great times.
In total, the Koistinen brothers were responsible for over 100 crimes over an 18-month period. When the police eventually caught up with them, their story was far from over. In the year 2000, following their arrest, the media frenzy kicked into high gear. Dubbed the Dalton Brothers of Eura, these four siblings had become household names across Finland, putting a spotlight on their small town. But for the brothers, that year was a whirlwind of police interrogations, court dates, and the prospect of jail time. The two younger brothers received probation, while Erki and his older brother faced 3 years in prison, which typically means serving half the sentence for first-time offenders. During their 18 months behind bars, the so-called Dalton brothers encountered significant notoriety that persisted for nearly a decade. Today, they've retreated from the limelight, with the youngest brothers especially keen on maintaining their privacy.
I think most of us are somehow fascinated and interested of motives of crimes. This is also has also been a personal interest for me, and this is one reason why also I have guided my professional career to investigate this, that what separates you and me from a person who commits crimes, so to say. And as we know, crime fiction is super popular if we look series or movies or and also true crime nowadays. I think many of us want to understand that what made that person to commit such a crime and act in such a way. And I think while we are investigating that, for example, through reading or watching a particular case, we are also mirroring that with ourselves and with other people, with this question that, okay, that what explains that the person acted in that manner? And it's a very thin line that what sort of, if we are not dealing with, a person who has long criminal history. But first timers, I think we are always a bit fascinated with those cases where a person has been, at least from outside looking, rather integrated into the society. A nice person talking to the neighbors and then suddenly committed a crime, it always comes a bit of a shock. So we want to understand that what were the factors and the elements that caused that, so to say. And it doesn't mean that I accept it in any way. Sometimes in people's minds these can be mixed, but understanding doesn't mean acceptance.
Erki's stint in prison was a period of introspection about his troubled past. Yet he harbored little regret for his criminal actions.
I never saw myself as a bad criminal, but I knew I was breaking the law. Breaking a bit of a concrete wall, sure, there would be consequences. Unfortunately, I still don't see myself as a criminal. I just bent some societal norms a bit. I guess that's criminal.
Erki finds it challenging to draw a line between himself and those deemed true criminals.
I wonder if it's different for other types of criminals, like murderers or rapists. Do they see themselves as criminals? Maybe not. Maybe they justify their actions somehow, blame someone else. I might do the same, blaming society. But it's important to admit when you've done wrong. I do that. I just don't like the label criminal. I'm trying to live differently now, not repeat past mistakes, and forgive myself.
Erki turned away from Lastarianism in his teens, carving out his own beliefs. Life has taught him forgiveness and empathy. But whether he has forgiven his father remains a personal journey.
Vaikea kysymys. Ei me ole pystynyt antaa.
That's a tough question. No, I haven't found complete forgiveness, the kind that sets you free. When I revisit those memories, I just can't. It would be great to be free of it all, but I don't want to put all the blame on our dad. He's been gone 20 years now. The only thing to do is own up to your actions. I don't want to look back and blame someone else. Whatever I did was due to my own stupidity.
The story of the Dalton brothers of Eura is as unique as it is complex. While one may understand the trajectory from dire poverty to crime, it doesn't excuse their actions. Upon capture, they expressed relief. Post-conviction, their reintegration into society has been successful, at least in that they've steered clear of further serious offenses. These narratives are not isolated. While the Koistinen family's tale is particularly extreme, it reflects broader issues of poverty and social marginalization. Economic downturns have often plunged families into hardship, with the children bearing the brunt of the resulting trauma potentially spanning generations.
This episode was written and reported by Marika Honkatukia. The script consultant was Eli Salo. Producer and sound designer was Suvi Tuli Kataya. Narrated by Tova Valnay. Executive producer is Nils Bergman. Nordic Crimes is a Tall Tale production. Please rate, review, and recommend the show to friends. Your support helps us reach listeners who might also appreciate the content. Thank you in advance.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.